While it was in the 1900s, Thomas Alva Edison was trying to develop some kind of device that would allow him to communicate with the dead. He never finished it. He died. But this is what he wrote before his death. If our personality survives, then it is strictly logical and scientific to assume that it retains memory, intellect, and other faculties and knowledge that we acquire on this earth. Therefore, if personality exists after what we call death, it is reasonable to conclude that those who leave this earth would like to communicate with those they have left here. I am inclined to believe that our personality hereafter will be able to affect that. If this reasoning to be correct, then we can evolve an instrument so delicate as to be affected or moved or manipulated by our personality as it survives in the next life. Such an instrument, when made available, ought to record something. He passed away, was never able to finish this thing. And I think if anybody was able to make one, it would have been Thomas Alva Edison. In a moment, our special guest will be Deborah Blum as we talk about ghost hunters William James and the search for scientific proof of life after death. Deborah Blum is a Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer and professor of journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's the author of four books, most recently Ghost Hunters, William James and the Search for Scientific Proof of Life After Death. She's written for numerous publications ranging from The New York Times to Discover Magazine. She is a past president of the National Association of Science Writers and currently serving on a board, advisory board to the National Academy of Sciences. She's our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hello, Deborah. Welcome to the program.
Hello. It's great to be here.
Nice job, by the way, on the book Ghost Hunters. Very thorough. And, you know, it's a tough subject, and you handled it very, very well.
It's a fascinating subject, though, don't you think?
Yeah, I do. How did you, you know, science writer, how did you get interested in this?
Little Miss Mainstream Science.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I get asked that a lot, mostly by my mainstream science writing friends. Well, I was interested in the history of psychology. I love the story of where we came from, and I was just sort of poking around, and one day I started seeing these references to William James, who, you know, was a major psychologist and philosopher of the late 19th century and early 20th. And they kept saying, basically, William has lost his mind and real scientists cannot follow him. And I thought, well, that's odd. I wonder why they said that. I never heard that. And that really got me started. I just wanted to find out why people thought he'd gone crazy.
And what about the theory real journalists can't cover this either? How did you feel? How did your colleagues react to some of this?
You know, negatively. I actually, when I first started working on this book, I was still president of the National Association of Science Writers, and one of the other officers asked me to wait to write it until I was no longer an officer, because so many of my science writing friends considered this pseudoscience, and that really wasn't what I was interested in. What I was interested in was saying, can science, real science, give us some clues here? People were really upset by that.
And you know, it's unfortunate that real science really doesn't pursue this, because if they would, I think they would find out that there is something in this universe. There's a cross between the physical and the non-physical. There's something out there, Deborah. And I think they'd find it. I think they'd get some answers. And it's unfortunate they're not pursuing this.
Well, you know, actually, I agree with you. And that's been, you know, something of a change for me, or at least a mind-opening experience in doing this book, because the people I was writing about were so smart. They were, you know, Nobel laureates. They were really world-leading scientists. And when you look at how they approach the issue, you think, if we could get scientists this smart again to really put some energy into this, I know they could find some answers, because the questions are so interesting.
Well, I love it, and you ought to be congratulated for what you do. You know, we stand out there with some other fine people who have their own alternative programs, trying to get the truth out, trying to get answers, and to get support from people like you, whom I respect greatly. I mean, it's a great feeling.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, when I talked to my editor about doing the book, I said to her, you know, what's the point of having all of these years of building up credibility if you can't burn it up a little on something that you think is an interesting idea? So this is sort of my shot to do that.
I fought with my producer over your book, but I won.
Oh, you did.
You know, tonight we'll talk about a lot of things. The long program, 3 hours, so you might not be accustomed to that. In the last hour, we'll open up the phone lines because people can either share stories with us or just ask you a question or two. But tell us a little bit more about William James and how you keyed in on him.
Well, William James was a founder of the study of psychology in the United States. He came from a wealthy New England family, quite an eccentric family, and quite a successful family. His brother, Henry James, was a famous novelist of the time and wrote one of the best ghost stories of the time called The Turn of the Screw. And William James wrote the book, the founding book for psychology in the United States, Principles of Psychology, and then went on to become one of the leading philosophers of the early 20th century. I found him just fascinating, you know, funny, smart, brilliant, and fearless, which is one of the things I liked about him, that he was fearless in his insistence on saying, you know, let's not set limits on the world, and was willing to take some major professional hits.
Did his views change as his career progressed, as he got older?
No, which is interesting. I mean, one of the things I do want to say about him is that if you read the standard biography of William James, the scholarly version, this interest of his in what we call the paranormal now and what they called psychical research then, he held on to that for more than 20 years. And it's almost a footnote in the usual biographies of him. But he became interested in it, you know, early in the 1880s and was still writing about it to his death. The only thing that changed was that his father was a quite eccentric spiritualist and a kind of, dictatorial believer in Swedenborg and some of his spirit mm-hmm. theories. And that was a very negative influence on both William and Henry. Their father would blame, you know, the evil spirits of the household for every bad behavior that they had. And so the one thing that was really interesting was that after a childhood saying, I'll never believe in a spirit life, as he began the research, you see him starting to say, wait a minute, there's something here.
He also partnered up with someone who was once a skeptic, right, and kind of changed down the line?
Richard Hodgson here in this country, who was the sort of executive director of the American Society for Psychical Research. And he was a really interesting person. He was an Australian. He was a philosophy major and an anthropologist. He's actually a founding member of the American Anthropological Association. And he began as a sort of debunker of mediums and psychics. His most famous case was that he hunted down Helena Blavatsky all the way to India to prove that she was a fraud. And her shrine in India was burned to the ground upon his visit, and she fled the country. And so when he came to the United States, he came with the specific intention of whipping American psychical researchers into shape and to expose a medium that William James had found unusually interesting.
Yet he didn't do that.
He became completely converted. He actually, by the end of his career, was writing national articles on the evidence for spirit life. And that was mainly based on his work with this one medium, but also, you know, his sort of bigger picture work talking to people around the country about their experiences.
You know, even on this program, Deborah, our quest is to try to get as many answers as we can. And in so doing, we run across some guests who may not be real. They may be downright frauds, for crying out loud. You know, that's very possible. Yet every once in a while, you'll come across the dedicated researcher, the person who really cares about what they're doing in this field. And they've come across some very fascinating things. And, you know, I've walked away from it thinking, I really don't know what it is, but I know there's something out there. And you know what? I think for someone who has an open mind, like I hope I do, you know, you can't ask for much more than that. You know, to simply say, there's something out there, I just don't know what it is. And so you continue this quest to look for the answer, and that's healthy. But every once in a while, you know, I come across someone who, you know, I'm a little skittish of. I got to tell you.
Yeah, you know, and the story that I told has a lot of fraud in it. I mean, one of the things James said is that if you have a small percentage that's real, it offers great opportunity for, you know, con artists and scammers to build upon that, and that they thrive because of that small percent of reality. I think that's right. And in my story, one of the things that the scholars who I'm calling ghost hunters do is they're very skeptical. They do expose a lot of, you know, to me sometimes fairly hilarious fraud. It is the Victorian time. It's the 19th century. So by our standards, this is pure comedy, some of the kind of cons that people tried on. But in the end, what they said was that they believed that they had found at least, and your percentage could be higher, but they said 5%, undeniably real. So one of the things that I started saying to myself is, I think this is the best scientific ghost hunt in history. Certainly, you know, the most brilliant scientists of the time are some of them. And so if it's the best and they think this 5% is real, what was the 5%?
And I am sure that 5% baffled them. They couldn't explain it. And it probably kept driving them to try to get these answers.
That's exactly right. And it's baffling to me. I go back and I read some of these, and, you know, I've told people I could, like, hang myself upside down from a tree, and I've been a professional, very skeptical journalist for a long time, but I read some of these accounts, and they are not explicable by what I think of as the known laws of science. And in fact, I was just talking to one of my students at the university today who had read the book, and he said, "What was that?" And I said, "It's really strange stuff."
Have you lost a loved one and thought perhaps they were coming back or strange things occurred? Has that happened to you yet?
It has not, although when I was working with the American Society for Psychical Research, I did participate in one of their ESP or telepathy experiments, which surprised me because I think of myself as completely untalented in any psychic way. You know, I actually thought that was one of the things that made me such a good person to do the book, because, you know, I'm so grounded and so boring, I suppose, in that sense. But my father-in-law had a very interesting crisis apparition experience, which is one of the things that interested me in the book. And his is a good story. I'd be happy to tell it.
Oh, yeah, please, go ahead.
Okay, well, my father-in-law lives in the San Joaquin Valley of California, and he is a small businessman and a former fire chief, and as down-to-earth a Norwegian-American as you will ever meet. And this happened about 20 years ago. He suddenly sat up in the middle of the night. It's about 3 a.m., and he sat up in bed so abruptly that he woke up my mother-in-law, who was sitting next to him, and she's like, "What? What?" And he goes, "Bob's calling." Bob was his cousin. And she sits up, and they're both listening, and it's completely silent, and she goes, "You know, it's a bad dream. Go back to sleep." So he lies back down, And then about 15 or so minutes later, he's up again. He goes, no, he's calling me. He's out in the yard. I'm going to get him. And he goes out in the dark and wanders all around their yard looking for his cousin. Of course, there's no one there, you know, the trees. And he finally comes back to bed, and they have one of those, was it the chili kind of conversations?
Yeah.
And then later that morning, his nephew calls him, and at the moment that he'd been wandering around in the yard, his cousin had committed suicide, shot himself in the head.
Oh, my.
Isn't that great?
Yeah,
and
is.
How do you explain that?
You can't.
That's
an
inexplicable happening.
One of the things I want to do tonight, when we open up the phone lines in our third hour, of course, if people want to ask you a question, that's fine. But I'd like them, because you're going to hear some incredible stories about the supernatural, ghost stories. But what I'd like to do, because you're a journalist and you know you've gone down this this alley now with this topic, I'd like, after they're done with their phone call to us and to you, I'd like you to tell us whether you believe their story or not. I'm not here to debunk anybody, but I'm curious to see what your impressions are, because you're the program tonight, Deborah, and I'd like to get your impressions on their story when they call in later. And I think that you'll share a lot of our feelings, that some of them are pretty darn compelling.
I'd love to do that. And it's been interesting to me because some of the theories that I always think of the people I write about as mine, right? So some of the theories that my guys came up with, when people, and I have heard since I started doing this book, stories that no one would have told me when I was writing about, you know, global climate change or Darwinian theory, say. But I have heard stories that fit so perfectly into some of these theories. And my father-in-law's story does. So it will be really interesting for me to do that.
A long time ago, when I was doing my local radio show in St. Louis there, I called myself the Nighthawk. I got a call from a guy. I've told this story several times, but there's been so much time in between the last time I said it, I don't know how many people remember it. So I'm gonna tell you it. And this guy called me and he said, George, I want to tell you a story about what happened to me about a year or so ago. He said, I was so depressed, I was thinking of committing suicide. And he said, I got in my car and I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I really thought about doing it. And I just drove. He drove about 100 miles from the city, which I assume was St. Louis for him. And he said, I kind of pulled off the freeway and into this town. There was a little lake there. It was a pretty day. Ducks were like hitting the water and flying out again. And he said, I sat on a bench and I just contemplated things. And he says, I was pretty depressed. And he said, oh, about a half hour later, some old guy came by and he sat down on the bench next to me and we just talked. And we talked for about an hour just about life and about things. And he said, I felt so good about myself when I was done talking to this guy that I really think he saved my life. I thanked him and I left. I got back in my car and I went back home. A year later, my life had changed. I found a woman that I loved. I got a new job. Everything's going great for me. I decided to go back to that town and thank him. He saved my life. He goes back to the town, doesn't know the guy's last name, doesn't know where to find him. So he figures, hey, a little town like this, they've got to have just a barber shop. So he goes to the barber and he says, hey, you know, describe the guy. And the barber kind of interrupted him and said, hey, why don't you just go up the street, up the hill a little bit. You're going to see a white house. His daughter's there. Go talk to her. And he said, okay, I did. But he said the way the barber was talking to him, it was as if something was wrong. So he goes to the house, knocks on the door. The woman comes to the door and he says, excuse me, I wanted to thank your father for something he did about a year ago for me. He saved my life. And I just, and she said, let me interrupt you because you're the fifth person in the last couple of years to come up and say that to me. My father died 15 years ago. I mean, and it's just, it's chilling. I don't know if the guy, Deborah, made that story up or not, but it's something I will never forget.
Boy, you know, this sounds so hokey, but I actually just broke out in goosebumps. That's an amazing story.
Yeah, I know. And same thing when I first heard it, and I still, My hairs on my arms still stand up. Stay with us, Deborah. We're going to take a quick commercial break. We're going to come right back with you and find out how you set the stage. You went into the Victorian era for this story on ghost hunters. Incredible book. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, those of you up there in the San Francisco area listening to us on KSFO, I'm going to be up there on Saturday, September 9th at an event called, of course, the Bay Area UFO Expo. I'm going to be there from 1 until 3 o'clock, so come on by. It's going to be a little meet and greet. Love to talk with you. If you need more information, there is a toll-free number. That's It's not a toll-free number. It's 209-836-4281. That's 209-836-4281. Or their website. That's free to go to. That's the Bay Area UFOExpo.com. Okay, welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight, Deborah Blum. She's the author of Ghost Hunters, William James and the Search for Scientific Proof of Life After Death. We haven't talked too much, Deborah, about the third character in this scenario. James, was it Hyslop? Is that how you pronounce his last name?
Hyslop.
Tell me a little bit about him.
He was a professor of philosophy at Columbia who, again, started out very skeptical, and he became also intrigued by this medium that I was telling you about, Leonora Piper of Boston, and he decided that, again, he would disprove her ability to talk to spirits, and he actually scheduled some meetings in which he came four times under an assumed name, and he came in wearing a mask.
He was determined, wasn't he?
He was totally determined, and he was only allowed, the medium only knew him as Four Times Friend, which was a code name because he was coming four times, and he went in, and he was determined, as so many people were, to not give her any information, and it was about on his second visit that she started talking about his dead father and actually in her trances would bring his dead father into the room. And the spirit that she appeared to be bringing to talk to him knew things that spirit simply couldn't have known. And he actually then spent months writing to his relatives, trying to find out parts of his father's history. About, I guess, 85% of what she told him could be proved. And he ended up also being a convert to this idea of spirit communication. And it cost him his job.
So isn't it interesting that they got pulled over onto the other side when they didn't start there?
To me, that was one of the more fascinating things, is that you had these very skeptical people, and they did really, because they were scientists, they tried very hard to sort of control the experiment and test it from all kinds of levels. For instance, Leonora Piper was what you call a trance medium. She would go into trances. And poor thing, they did all these tests to show that her trance was a fraud. They stuck needles in her arms. They stuck needles in her lips. They put lye in her mouth. They put ammonia up her nose, trying to prove that she was faking the trance. And in fact, she never did, no matter what they did, come out of the trance, although she sometimes woke up with burns and other injuries from all these attempts they made to bring her out of this so-called fake trance.
Did in your research, not necessarily for this book, did you ever look into Harry Houdini and his obsession with the afterlife? And what he wanted, he tried to find his mother. I mean, he loved her so much, he wanted to find her in death. And, man, he went to medium after medium and just couldn't find her. And then I think prior to his death, he told his wife, Bess, they had some kind of a code. He said, "We're going to communicate when I go. This is we'll try this." And I think she ended up going to one medium eventually, who had the code and passed it. And I don't know if that was a myth or not, Deborah, but I don't know if you came across that in anything.
I did, and I've heard that story too, that his wife eventually got the code. Yeah, I've heard that. You know, everyone sort of second-guessed that because it was so specific. You know, and some people speculated that the medium had somehow been able to sneak away and see the code. Houdini, during his life, was terribly disappointed. And he, you know, eventually worked very hard to expose frauds and did successfully expose some frauds. He wrote a wonderful book called A Magician Among the Spirits, in which he looks at some of those issues. My take, this is my personal take, is that whether that 5% number is right or not, a really good medium is hard to find.
You know, it just takes one. It doesn't even, you don't even have to worry about a percent. You know, as I used to tell some of our experts who talk about this crop formation phenomenon, you know, if you're looking at 1,000 crop formations and 999 of them are frauds, you've got one that might be real. That's all you need.
Right.
That's all you need.
That's exactly right. And I think also Houdini, you know, was quite a good friend of Alfred Conan Doyle, who was a dedicated spiritualist.
Yes.
I think that he, you know, for all his exposés, he never quite obviously gave up. And my suspicion is that he occasionally bumped into something that made him believe he just hadn't found the right person.
Cover of your book, Ghost Hunters, obviously the Victorian garb here.
Yes.
Tell me about the cover. Is that an actual picture or was that staged for the book? Because it's a great one.
Isn't that a great picture?
Yeah, sure it is.
It's an actual picture. It actually was from an exhibit that was in the Metropolitan Museum of New York called The Perfect Medium, Photography and the Occult, that appeared about a year ago. And, you know, I'm just going to describe it for people who haven't seen it, but it has a man sitting in a corner who is a scientist, a German researcher. And then across from him is a woman in obviously Victorian clothes. She's got her hands held apart and over her lap, and you see this glowing light between her hands, and she's looking down very seriously at this light. And that's a picture of a European medium named Eva Stee, was her, you know, her working name. And she was what they called a manifestation medium, that she would communicate with the spirits. And one of the things she could do was ask the spirits to actually create light. And in this picture, what the experiment was, she was given like a length of cotton thread, and she holds it between her hands and concentrates, and it begins to glow. And that's a picture of one of those experiments.
Why is it that every scientist looks like Sigmund Freud in that era? Did you notice that? He looks just like him.
So they're almost, you know, I think they all cut their hair the same way. And there must have been some science uniform, right? They're all, except for William James, who liked to dress for comfort. And people used to make fun of the way he dressed. They were all wearing those stuffy Victorian suits.
Why did you focus on the Victorian era? Was it because of William James and the other two? Or was there something special about that time period?
You know, William James, it was the other two. They had some counterparts in Europe. Two of them won Nobel Prizes, one of whom was an early inventor of radio communication. And what I said to myself is, okay, these are really brilliant scientists. And they're sort of at the start of this. And they're at a period when, at least briefly, it was acceptable. It was actually acceptable for leading scientists to explore this. And their papers got published in the journal Science and the journal Nature. And so that really fascinated me, that you had this sort of window where really good scientists could do the work. And I wanted to see what they found. In the same way that you might say, boy, if a bunch of leading scientists and a few Nobel laureates put all their energy into this now, what would they find?
When the three started their research, what did they do? How did they set it up and some of the results that they obtained?
Well, they did. They looked at all kinds of things. They looked at telepathy. They looked at haunted houses. They studied what they thought of as credible mediums. And they looked at what I call the everyday supernatural, which is, you know, experiences that people have, you know, sane and normal people who just have an unexpected supernatural occurrence. And so one of the things they did is actually do a statistical analysis of crisis apparitions like the one I mentioned that my father-in-law had. And they gathered thousands and thousands of those and then compared them to, you know, the rate of death in countries on four different continents, and were able to show that those crisis apparitions occur at more than 400 times above chance. So once they had gotten that statistic, they started saying, well, what might explain them? And they did some really wonderful theories involving different forms of energy. And then they did these experiments with mediums in which the medium experiments were very tightly controlled. And they looked at what can you tell us? If we tell you nothing, what can you tell us? And some of those results are incredible. And then the last thing they did as they rushed through all their experiments is right at the end of, it was very close to the end of James' life. He died in 1910. They did an experiment. They had mediums on three different continents, and they had a kind of spirit relay system of giving information to a medium in Asia. It was the writer Rudyard Kipling's sister who was living in India,
okay,
and asking that information be sent to England and then on to the United States. And that was cross correspondence experiments.
They tried it via what, telepathy?
They did a lot of telepathy, but in some cases they were actually asking that the mediums communicate directly with spirits. And so to give you an example, they were trying to communicate with some of the people in their organization who had died. And one of them was a classic scholar who was fluent in Greek and Latin. And so they gave this American medium, Leonora Piper, a message in Latin which she did not speak, and asked her to ask the spirit of this dead scholar to give information to another medium. And, in fact, that happened. So they were using that to try to say, let's go beyond what this medium could accomplish, right? Let's give her a language she couldn't even speak and see if we can relay the information. And there was a really nice sequence in which they asked that medium, for instance, to close whatever message she sent to the other medium with an arrow. And within a week, the medium, you know, hundreds of miles away, was drawing arrows. I mean, some of it you just think, okay. You know, there's something really interesting going on here that I wish I understood better.
Did they conclude that whatever they were stumbling across was supernatural, or maybe a very natural existence that was part of the universe, always there, and we were just trying to gain more knowledge about it?
That's a great question, and I think that one of the reasons that this period so much appealed to me is that they were looking to establish natural laws that would explain this. And that really works for me. I want to have almost a mechanism. I'm a science writer. And they were looking at saying, you know, we like to say that this is supernatural, but if we could really understand it, you know, this is part of the universe, and there are explanations that could make this work really well. I think one of the things they concluded, which I happen to like, is that because we're so dismissive of all of these events or occurrences or experiences, we tend to underestimate ourselves. I mean, they really believed that we have a great ability to communicate at what they called subliminal levels. In fact, they were the first to publish Freud in Britain. And that if we would acknowledge that, then we might be able to get a handle on, you know, whatever energy allows people to communicate telepathically. And so one of their theories was that some spirit communication just might be an enhanced form of telepathic communication.
We handle all kinds of subject matter on this program, Deborah, but whenever I'm out, two subjects always crop up from people, and they say, do you believe in UFOs? Do you believe in ghosts? And in terms of the ghost end, when I tell them that I do and they don't, I come back with this very simple phrase. I say, can you explain why you're here and who you are? And they can't give me an answer. And once they start to stumble trying to figure out just why they're here and what their existence means, I open up the door for the ghost end. And I say, it's entirely possible if you don't even know why you're on this planet, if you don't even know what your role is in this universe, how can you negate the fact that there could be something else out there where yourself, your soul goes to, becomes part of? By the time that's done, they're so baffled that they have to accept the fact that there's that possibility that the life after death existence is there.
Yeah, I think that's a really smart way of looking at it. And one of the things I started to say to people is, okay, you know, if you're going to say that the only way to measure and define reality is science as we know it today, then just take something, you know, to repeat myself one more time, like my father-in-law's experience with hearing his cousin. Okay, I'm a scientist. How do I tell you what that is? Because science asks that it be replicable or repeatable. It asks that it be predictable. It asks that it be quantifiable or measurable. So if you have a phenomenon and you can't apply the rules of science to it, what it really tells us is science hasn't grown up enough. It doesn't tell you that it's not real.
Are you baffled? Because I don't think we have answers for what's over there, what's on the other side. But are you convinced that it's there now?
Yeah, I think there's something there, and I am baffled. I find myself saying, there's fascinating. I love patterns. I think that all good journalists, if you're any good, you see a pattern, and you recognize it as that, pattern recognition. And to me, I've begun to see these really fascinating patterns. And I said to myself, what are they? What are they trying to tell us? I wish that we knew enough to read them.
You know, when we talk about angels, for example, I put all of them in the same category with the ghosts. There's just something very special about this universe that is out there, that has always been there. And it's all part of it. And, you know, maybe the answer comes for all of us when we pass on. And we either realize one way or another that it's there, and if it's not there, I don't think we're going to know about it anyway, because that's it.
I don't think there's anything wrong with a little mystery in life. I mean, I do think one of the reasons people rebel against science is that science puts you in a nice, neat, little quantifiable box. And a lot of people don't want to be quite that limited in the way they see the world.
Hey, the book Ghost Hunters, where do you get it, by the way?
Oh, Amazon, but it's in, you know, Barnes & Noble and Borders and a lot of bookstores, I hope.
It just came out, didn't it?
It's only been out a couple of weeks.
So, right, great.
And actually, I'll tell you, it's been very gratifying because, it's been reviewed twice in the New York Times, and that says to me that there's, you know, more interest at this at some levels than I had expected, and I like that. I want to make people think about these things.
Well, I tell you, I don't know where it started before you started the program tonight on Amazon, but when it's all over tomorrow morning, go pop it and take a look at where your ranking is. You will be pleasantly surprised.
I would love to see that.
This is a subject matter so dear to the hearts of everybody who listens to this program. When we come back at the top of the hour, let's talk a little bit about the trilogy's work on haunted houses and also the kinds of evidence that they came up with or looked for life after death. We'll do that. Then, as I was saying, in the last hour, phone calls for Deborah, questions for Deborah, but those of you who tell us specific ghost stories, after you're done with the story, I'm going to just ask Deborah if she believes that story or not. I want to get her take on it. I want to see how this evolution has occurred for all of us. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.